A forest fire rages in Canada today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. An oil-rich city in Canada is battling a massive forest fire. A local fire chief says the city's a charred mess, and all residents have been evacuated.
It's been the worst day of my career. And the people here are devastated.
Plus, Doctors Without Borders says hospitals in war zones must be protected from attacks.
We want countries to make sure that they would prevent attacks on hospital, on patient, on healthcare worker. That's what it's all about for me.
And a chef remembers the unlikely start to her culinary career.
I grew up in a house where nobody cooked.
Those stories plus a look at Iran's tech startup scene today on The World. Glad you could make it today. There's oil, and then there's tough oil, oil that is in places that are tough to get to or tough to extract it from. But oil prices are low, and that's been changing all sorts of calculations, from startups in Iran to piracy on the high seas.
There's not as much money to be made from selling stolen oil, and that's caused a shift towards a kidnapping for ransom model.
We go first, though, to Canada's capital of tough oil, where wildfires have been raging. Fort McMurray in northern Alberta. Entire neighborhoods have burned, forcing tens of thousands to abandon their homes. One woman there said it felt like the apocalypse. Fort McMurray Fire Chief Darby Allen said yesterday was the worst day of his career.
We're still fighting this blaze, and it's nasty. It's a nasty, ugly fire, and it is not showing any forgiveness. We are under currently a mandatory evacuation for the entire area of Fort McMurray.
So far, there's been no damage reported to Canada's oil sands industry, located north of the city. But it is a completely different scene in Fort McMurray, which is where I caught up with reporter Brianna Carson-Smith.
From where we are right now, we can't see any fire. It's a big change from yesterday when we were evacuating from the city. We were driving south around midnight and could still see huge flames from the highway, even off in the distance. But today we can't see any flames, but that's quite typical for a morning at a wildfire. Usually the humidity dampens it quite a bit, so we are expecting that it would pick up again when the heat comes up again and the winds come up and stoke this fire. So as far as we understand, it is still very much out of control.
So how massive has the firefighting effort been? Like, what kind of equipment and personnel are they putting on this wildfire?
Everything in the province that they can get here. As of yesterday, they had about 100 firefighters on the ground fighting this fire until it came out of control. And that's when they sort of pulled the plug and said, anyone who can get here needs to get here. And we were driving south on the highway out of town, getting to safety, and dozens of fire trucks from other municipalities were driving north into the fire to help. And they truly are coming from all over the province, far and wide, and bringing whatever resources they can. There is a large group of fire crews fighting this blaze.
Brianna, you've been regularly posting tweets about what you're seeing. For example, the entire city is just covered in white smoke. We can't see very far in any direction. Let me ask you about a couple of them. 80% of homes have been lost in Beacon Hill. We have yet to see the 20%.
We're actually sitting in Beacon Hill right now as we speak, and I don't even have words for it. It's flattened. Like, there are foundations and nothing else. Very little. We've seen burned out trucks. Strange, odd things like a bookcase that's still standing, and it's just such an eerie thing to see. Basically, people's lives up flames, ashes everywhere, and as far as the eye can see, I'm truly not lying when I say we can't see that 20% from where we are. We see that 80%. There is nothing standing in Beacon Hill where we are.
Here's another one. You write, a man just gave us eyewash, water, and upgraded our masks. Even when you think you're alone, you're not.
That gentleman was so kind because we had face masks yesterday that were cotton, and they just soak up the smoke, and they seemed very ineffective this morning. So the random stranger just popped by and said, you know, here, have these. And truly, if we felt alone because there's no one else here, it seems like, and then suddenly when you need something, someone shows up, it's really heartwarming.
Here's another tweet, final one. We just talked to the woman from the house on the right. She's devastated but says it's just a house. Brianna, is everyone like her?
Yeah, we were driving down the highway and we looked over and saw these backyards where you could see into the back of the house through their backyards. Fire had just engulfed the back of these houses. And then a camera guy was shooting this. He goes, there's someone in there. So we went and looked, and sure enough, the couple who's from that home was in there taking out whatever they could. They were taking out Kraft dinner. They were taking jugs. They were just whatever they could salvage. They had bags packed when they evacuated yesterday, but were just sort of going in knowing that this was the last that they were going to see of their house. And she was, I think, still in shock, very calm. You know, as she said, at least they have their lives.
A lot of people like her putting things in perspective like that.
It's quite incredible to talk to the people. Everyone, I think, is so devastated just seeing what this city looks like today, seeing how destroyed it is. But, you know, the hospital is still standing. The provincial government building is still standing. You know, there's those little victories, and so far, no casualties, no injuries. It's those things that people are holding on to as the beacon of hope, really.
Reporter Brianna Carson-Smith in the center of Fort McMurray, thanks so much for speaking with
us. Thank you.
The pictures coming out of Fort McMurray are harrowing. Long lines of cars fleeing the city, framed by giant plumes of smoke and flames. You can see some of those images at PRI.org. As we said, Alberta's tar sands industry, where the U.S. gets most of its imported oil, doesn't seem to be threatened by the fires. The low price of oil has affected it, though. It's also affected the economy in Iran, which is just starting to recover from years of sanctions. But Iranian youth see big potential in high tech. I found a booming tech startup scene in Tehran when I was there in February. Vivian Walt, the Paris-based correspondent for Time and Fortune magazines, found something similar when she sat in with young entrepreneurs in Tehran as they pitched new products to German and Austrian investors.
Of course, they kind of dream of being in the real Silicon Valley. I think every person there would have maybe preferred to have been in Cupertino than in Tehran. Mm. But nonetheless, they do have this kind of sense, it's not particularly concrete right now, but the sense that they're on the cusp of something big.
Did it seem like, as those tech startup guys were preparing for that pitch meeting, did it seem like there was something to offer the German and Austrian investors?
Well, I think they were surprised by the skepticism that they met. You know, if you don't meet many foreigners and you're simply in Tehran, it's quite easy to believe that everything's great and that, you know, you're just going to kind of boom your way, you know, to success. But the Germans and Austrians arrived with a much more skeptical eye on the tech scene. And they looked at a lot of these guys and said, okay, you know, this sounds great, but it's all really just copies of what the Americans are doing. That's the one thing. And the second problem is that, of course, in every sector of the economy, including the tech sector, there's this tremendous uncertainty of what the future holds, whether the reformists will remain in power, whether there might be new sanctions ahead. And so it's very difficult for these foreign investors to imagine putting in millions of dollars.
I mean, I met a lot of Iranians who did leave the tech sector in Canada, in the West, thinking the new kind of air in Iran after the nuclear deal would be beneficial to them. Are they discouraged yet or kind of still pumped?
They're still pumped. I mean, by and large, there is still this feeling of great optimism that there's really a turning point in the country. And as one young Iranian, not that young, 36 years old, Iranian said to me, the head of Digicala, which is maybe the most successful e-commerce site in Iran, he said, look, our generation, the generation born after the revolution, is huge, and we really have the power to change the country.
As you pointed out, these young tech entrepreneurs have found their role models in the West and in the private sector. What was your read on how the Iranian regime is swallowing this irony?
Well, it's clear they want to be as Western as they can possibly be. They're watching everything on YouTube and iTunes, and they would be perfectly at home in any suburb of LA or Boston at this point. But nonetheless, you know, the government realizes that they have a problem. They realize that the answer is not necessarily to crack down on them. They just don't quite know what to do. And as one hardline editor said to me, you know, we have a real problem in the way we bring up our youth in this country because they look like Westerners, they speak like Westerners, and we don't really have a real alternative that's attractive enough for them.
Vivian Walt, the Paris-based correspondent for Time and Fortune magazines, just back from Iran. Thanks so much, Vivian, for your time.
You're welcome.
Low oil prices have also changed the tactics of pirates in West Africa, the ones we read about who hijack oil tankers. They typically commandeer a vessel, siphon off the fuel, and resell it on the black market. But that's the old business model, says Matt Walji. He's the project officer at Oceans Beyond Piracy, and he's the lead author of that group's latest report, The State of Maritime Piracy, 2015.
There's not as much money to be made from selling stolen oil, and that's caused a shift towards a kidnapping for ransom model in the Gulf of Guinea. And that's very concerning to the maritime industry, and obviously the human costs have increased significantly as a result. They generally target the higher-ranking officers under the assumption that you can get more, they're more valuable, if you will. And I know it sounds terrible to put a price on a human life that way, but that seems to be the reasoning behind how the pirates are operating. They'll hijack two or three, sometimes four individuals off of these vessels and hold them inland for about 3 to 4 weeks usually. So it's much shorter duration than the Somali pirates.
You know, I still find it astonishing that a few pirates in flip-flops and a tiny skiff can sidle up to a tanker longer than a few football fields and take over the ship, whether it's kidnapping or oil siphoning. Do you have a clear idea of how that actually happens?
The pirates, they come alongside in high-speed skiffs. In Gulf of Guinea, they tend to try and attack tankers while they're drifting or steaming at slow speeds, and not just tankers, but any vessels while they're at anchor or drifting. They then use a ladder or a rope with a grapple hook on it and toss that up the side and climb aboard. They're lured aboard by the expectation that they can potentially make a lot of money or make a living at this when there's generally a lack of opportunity where they're from.
Do these international shipping companies pay ransoms to these pirates?
That appears to be the case. As far as we know, all of the individuals have been released after a settlement has been achieved.
And if that ransom is ultimately paid, how does the money transfer happen? Because it's not like we're talking, you know, it's not like there's an ATM or just some kind of deposit on these ships. How do they hand the money over?
So for Somali pirates, they would actually do airdrops, and they would airdrop in a cash counting machine along with it to make the process a lot quicker, because obviously Somali pirates sitting there counting through stacks of $1 million is going to take quite a while, and they want to make this as quick as possible. So they'd airdrop a package that had the full ransom amount in cash with a cash counting machine. But in the Gulf of Guinea, it's a lot more mysterious. From what we understand of the process, and it's, again, it's kind of cloaked in mystery, if you will, it's intentionally kept shrouded to avoid encouraging increasingly high ransoms and dragging out the ransom negotiations. So in order to do that, they try to keep the process kind of as secretive as possible. But from what we understand, there's a negotiation that goes on. They arrive at a dollar amount. It seems to be kind of on a per individual rate because they're not holding the vessel itself. They're taking these individuals, the crew members, they're taking them up into the riverine in the Niger Delta and holding them on little islands kind of in swampy riverine areas while they negotiate this. But once they've reached a settlement, sometimes they'll reach a dollar amount and then the pirates will try to tack on additional things like iPhones or other electronics, things of that nature. And then once they've finally reached an agreement, they will take a security team in and a ransom drop team. They'll go to an agreed point and hand off the cash and then receive the seafarers back safely, hopefully anyway. So as a result of the fact that there's been no prosecutions, the pirates operate in an environment of relative impunity. And it's really tragic for the seafarers.
Matt Walji, project manager for Oceans Beyond Piracy. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, a plea to protect hospitals from the fighting in Syria. That's on the world. These days, any good news from Syria is often counterbalanced by lots of bad news. Today we hear that the U.S. and Russia have agreed to extend a partial ceasefire to Aleppo. But just yesterday, an international aid group had to plead with the U.N. Security Council to get the warring parties to stop bombing hospitals all over Syria.
We will not leave patients behind, and we will not be silent. Seeking or providing health care must not be a death sentence. You will be judged not on your words today, but on your actions.
That's Joanne Liu, the head of Médecins Sans Frontières, addressing the Security Council yesterday. Just last week, an attack on a hospital in Aleppo killed 50 people. Another one yesterday killed three more. Now, a deliberate attack on a hospital is a war crime. The Security Council did adopt a resolution reaffirming that. So I asked Joanne Liu how confident she was that this resolution would do much to stop the attacks.
Well, confident would be a big word. I think that what we got yesterday is what I call the beginning of a journey. We basically have done the easy step, which is passing a resolution. But what it does is the fact that it's a landmark to a certain extent. Now that the UN Security Council has, I would say, reaffirmed the state of play in terms of what is protected, what we need to safeguard, then we have something, you have a reference point. So it's not, this is something that unanimously the Security Council has passed.
Do you think the problem of bombing hospitals, has it always been there, or is it getting worse now?
This is a good question, and it's very difficult to answer it in terms of, I would say, hard data. The project of healthcare in danger done by RCRC, where they have compiled 2,400 attacks on healthcare worker medical facilities of ambulances over 3 years from beginning of 2012, end of 2014, give an average of 2 attacks on a daily basis. This is what we've got in terms of a bit of a benchmark, but we don't have benchmark before. I think it somehow has always happened. The fact that for us, for MSF, we had dramatic occurrences, dramatic attacks, Kunduz being very, very different, but not unique, unfortunately. We had several attacks in Yemen. We had several attacks in Syria, like I just said, but we had as well in South Sudan. Mm. We have as well in Central African Republic. So it's happening. And at the end of the day, our call is to make sure that in addition to just say we will pass a resolution, is we want countries to make sure that they would prevent attacks on hospital, on patient, on healthcare worker. That's what it's all about for me.
So as you said, these attacks on hospitals are happening in lots of places. Let me ask you about that attack on the hospital in Kunduz in Afghanistan last October. It's a case that directly affects Médecins Sans Frontières because it was on an MSF hospital. A U.S. gunship destroyed it. 42 people died. Do you think you'll ever be satisfied with how that case is dealt with?
I cannot predict the future, but at this stage, there is still, for us, the fact that we didn't get the independent, impartial investigation that we're asking for, because we truly believe that being the perpetrator, the judge, and the jury is not possible. And so right now, we're still not completely satisfied. On the other hand, we do acknowledge the fact that the U.S. has taken responsibility, and the reality on many of those attacks, very few nations have taken responsibility in the past. So they have done this, they have done an internal investigation, but for us, there's still some gray area, and then we would be satisfied with an independent and impartial investigation.
Joanne Liu, president of Doctors Without Borders, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joanne Liu mentioned Yemen, and our next story is about the war there, and about a British woman who follows a conflict in Yemen on Twitter. Last July, Jamila Hanan began following the story of Ibrahim Abdulkarim, a man who lost his daughter in an airstrike. A few months later, a photo popped up online.
Everybody was talking about it.
It was from the night of the attack, and it shows Abdulkarim hugging his 11-month-old daughter, Zainab. She's dressed in her burial shroud at the morgue. Hanan says this photo was different somehow.
I found it really touched men because, obviously, picture of a father with the daughter, and clearly he was extremely distressed. And whereas, you know, you see a lot of dead children, you see mothers grieving with children, and us women, we're always crying all the time. But there's not very much that really touches men, and the men were just sobbing over it. Certainly in Yemen they were, because they know that he's not the only one. You know, there's thousands like that.
UNICEF says more than 900 kids were killed in the Yemen war last year, so it's not an unusual story. But the photo of baby Zainab and her dad swept through Arab social media. Jamila Hanan keeps a blog where she documents civilian casualties of the Yemen war.
I thought, well, I should include a page on what happened to his daughter, so I collected the videos, looked for any documentation on it, and asked him if he would consider writing his testimony regarding what happened.
And that is the remarkable thing. This Yemeni man, who speaks only Arabic, has written one of the only first-person accounts by a victim of a Saudi coalition airstrike that we can now read. Last month, Hanan enlisted a Yemeni student at Harvard to translate the father's story into English. She arranged with a medical doctor in Yemen to translate it back into Arabic so that Ibrahim Abdulkarim could be sure his message was getting through accurately. We have it posted at PRI.org, along with a photo of baby Zainab and her father.
It's just incredibly sad. I'm actually looking at the photo now, actually, because I've just found the one that you sent me. I think, you know, just, I'm a mother. I know if that was my child, you know, I'd just be really, really heartbroken. It's unusual that you see a father grieving the child, because men, they grieve in private, so it's very unusual for a father to want to share this. And surely it was painful for him to do so. And the whole process he's gone through of reliving in his mind what happened, to write the account of what happened to him, to share it with the world, is an incredibly brave thing to do.
Jamila Hanan, a social media activist in the UK. A story mothers and fathers can all relate to. A quick look ahead now before the break. Our producer in London compares election politics in the U.S. and in Britain.
You know, we think sometimes in the U.S. that our election campaigns are sometimes wacky and harsh and different. But when you look at the campaign here, it's not, I mean, it's not Trump, but sometimes you feel that some of the tone has been very ugly.
More on that just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. She's one of the world's top athletes in her sport, but she grew up pretending to be a boy named Genghis Khan.
I was very good at it, and I became one of them, like boys and same mentality. And for years, people didn't know who am I.
She's Maria Turpakai, and she's a Pakistani squash superstar. That's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Let's talk politics, and not U.S. politics for a change. A political scandal has erupted in the U.K., and it's over anti-Semitism. Britain's Labour Party says they've suspended several members for making anti-Semitic comments. All this comes as Britain heads into local elections tomorrow. People in London will choose a new mayor. More on that in a few minutes. But first, here's The World's Matthew Bell on that political scandal.
This story begins with a Facebook post. Naz Shah is a member of the Labour Party. 2 years ago, before she won her seat in Parliament, Shah posted something about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It said, "Relocate Israel to the United States. Problem solved." That post and some others from Shah came to light last week, and she took some heat, including criticism from Prime Minister David Cameron, who's from the Conservative Party. Shah responded by standing up in Parliament to say she was sorry.
"I accept and understand that the words I used caused upset and hurt to the Jewish community, and I deeply regret that. Anti-Semitism is racism, full stop."
Things might have simmered down, but enter Ken Livingstone. He's a top official with the Labour Party and a former London mayor. He went on the BBC to defend Shah.
"But she's not anti-Semitic. Let's remember, when Hitler won his election in 1932, his policy then was that Jews should be moved to Israel. He was supporting Zionism, and his boy went mad and ended up killing 6 million Jews."
To many people listening, especially British Jews, Livingstone was crossing a line by drawing a parallel between Hitler and Zionism. He refused to back down from the comment. Now, both Livingstone and Naz Shah have been suspended by the Labour Party. Other suspensions followed, and there's an internal investigation into anti-Semitism among the party rank and file. Some insist that this is all a political tempest in a teapot. Ken Livingstone says in his 47 years as a Labour Party member, he's never heard any anti-Semitic comments.
"If Ken hasn't heard anything anti-Semitic in 47 years, he hasn't heard himself speak."
David Baddiel is a British writer and comedian whose Twitter bio simply says, "Jew."
the bigger issue here is the left does have an issue with Jews. The left portrays itself as the champion of the oppressed. That's its basic identity. But there's such a big hangover for them that the Jews are, of course, not that, that they are rich and powerful and controlling, and that therefore they don't fit into the category of the oppressed, particularly with their version of Israel, which, you know, as the oppressor. So therefore, the left does not extend to Jews the same protections that it extends to other minorities.
Politicians in Britain and much of Europe tend to be more willing to criticize Israel than on the U.S. political scene. Jonathan Friedland is a columnist with The Guardian newspaper based in London.
It was noticeable here that, for example, Bernie Sanders, who was hailed as being breaking lots of taboos by speaking up for the Palestinians in the United States, prefaced his remarks by saying, "I'm 100% supportive of Israel." I don't think there's many figures on the left who would dare say that here.
Friedland says there's a minority of politicians on the left in Britain who question the right of Israel to exist, and that their criticism of Israel and Zionism can sometimes tip over into classic anti-Jewish bigotry. He says challenging Israeli policy and its treatment of the Palestinians is fine. He does so often. But there is a point, Friedland says, where legitimate criticism ends and anti-Semitism begins.
So if somebody says the United States has no right to exist because of what the fate of the Native Americans, and says the same of Australia because of the Aboriginal people, and New Zealand for its indigenous people, and Argentina and Chile, and says that none of those countries have a right to exist, then fine that they're saying the same of Israel. But if they're only saying it of Israel, they're making an exception that every other people in the world has a right to exist and a right to self-determination except the Jews, then you wonder. And it's that kind of exceptionalism that I think is a useful guide.
Clearing the air on the issue of anti-Semitism in British politics might be a good thing, Friedland says. As one former Labour Party official put it to me, this is a cancer that cannot be allowed to grow. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
I mentioned a moment ago the race for mayor in London. Tomorrow is the election, and the focus is on the two main candidates. Their politics may not be that far apart, but their backgrounds are. Our own Shirin Jafari is in London. Tell us first, Shirin, about these two main candidates for mayor of London. Who are they?
One of them is called Sadiq Khan from the Labour Party. He was born in the UK, but his family immigrated from Pakistan. His father was a bus driver. His mother was a seamstress. Mm. And he grew up in a government-supported community. And then he went on to become a human rights lawyer, then went on to become transport minister. So he has done pretty well. The second candidate I wanted to talk about, Marco, is Zach Goldsmith. Goldsmith comes from a very different background compared to Sadiq Khan. He is a son of a millionaire. He went to an elite school. So you could say that he had a pretty privileged background. So that's what makes this race really interesting for somebody like me who's watching from outside and coming into the story as somebody who hasn't been following British politics.
Us a taste of what the campaign's been like. What struck you?
What struck me was the tone. You know, we think sometimes in the U.S. that our election campaigns are sometimes wacky and harsh and different. But when you look at the campaign here, it's not Trump, but sometimes you feel that some of the tone has been very ugly.
I mean, the Goldsmith campaign, I know, has been accused of trying to stoke up ethnic tensions among voters. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I was reading the paper here in London, which is called The Evening Standard. It's the paper that they hand out on the tube or the metro. And this is a really interesting headline I found there. This is a dog-eat-dog mayor election. I found out. I think this sums up the race really nicely. The conservative camp, meaning David Cameron and Zach Goldsmith, they have been trying to use this background of Sadiq Khan and sort of go out and tell voters that, listen, you don't want to vote for somebody who's not quote-unquote us. I spoke with a woman, her name is Anita Vasisht. She's an immigration lawyer here, and she told me that one Saturday back in April, she got a letter, and it was from Prime Minister David Cameron himself.
Before reading it, I went into the living room where my girls were lounging around on a Saturday morning looking at their screens or whatever they do as teenagers. And I said to them, look, the Prime Minister's written to me. I've got a letter from him. And it begins, "Dear Anita," so it just feels really personal.
And here's what the letter said.
"The British Indian community makes an extraordinary contribution to London and to Britain." And then it goes on, closer ties between the UK and India have been a priority for me as Prime Minister. I was pleased to join Zach Goldsmith and thousands of British Indians in welcoming Prime Minister Modi to the UK last year.
Right, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
Yeah, and Anita was actually pretty upset about this.
So as I was reading it, and I was just, what? What? The message to me doesn't in any way relate to our reality. We live in Hackney. We live in North London, you know, Northeast London. And our lives are firmly embedded there. So for my daughters especially, their whole identity is British. It's London, you know.
Wow, so a campaign strategy that kind of backfires because it seems kind of tone deaf. Shireen, what other issues have Sadiq Khan and Zach Goldsmith have been talking about on the campaign trail?
Some of the main points that they've been talking about is rent, for example, housing in London. Housing prices are just off the roof here. The other issue, Marco, was transport. I've been here for a week and I've been filling up my metro card over and over again. It's just so expensive to move around the city.
So Sadiq Khan is leading in the polls, I gather. How big a deal would it be if he gets elected mayor of London?
If you think about it, London is one of the most important cities in the world. And if Sadiq Khan wins, he's going to be the first Muslim mayor of any city in UK in the history.
Yeah, that would be historic. The world's Shireen Jafari in London. Thanks for telling us about this.
Thanks, Marco.
Time now for a name tag story. That's our occasional series on the stories behind place names. One person responsible for many names, British Royal Navy Captain George Vancouver. In the late 18th century, he went on a four-year expedition around the Pacific and named a lot of stuff.
Captain George Vancouver, after Cook, the greatest navigator in British naval history. Vancouver explored and charted the Pacific seacoast of North America. The name of the pioneer came naturally to be borrowed, for as the acting agent general observes,
he put British into British Columbia.
Yes, Vancouver put the British in British Columbia. He also named Mount Rainier after his friend, British Admiral Peter Rainier. Now one woman is on a quest to name a notch on that mountain after Vancouver. Whitney Henry Lester tells her story.
If you live in Seattle or Tacoma, Mount Rainier is somewhat of a regular sight, but never a common one. I'll be driving around Tacoma on a sunny day, running errands, and I'll crest a small hill, and suddenly, bam, there's the mountain towering over the entire city. But there's something about it I never noticed until I met Barbara Reed.
So we're looking at a map of Puget Sound.
And so Vancouver would have been here.
No, up here. But this is where they had lunch. Venison pasties.
Barbara has learned a lot about Captain Vancouver. Barbara was also born with a sense of adventure and a love of the water. She learned to sail while stationed in Vietnam in the Army, and she once lived on her boat in Hawaii, and then sailed for 3 weeks to move to the Northwest.
There's nothing like moving a vessel through the wind. There's so many magical, magical moments when you're at one with the ship, you're at one with God.
Barbara started to read the journals of the early explorers. She read all of Captain Vancouver's journals. On Saturday, May 26, 1792, Vancouver wrote about something he saw from his ship, something Barbara had never noticed. The quote, "appearance of a very abrupt division in the snowy range of mountains immediately to the south of Mount Rainier."
That's what got my attention. Well, my goodness, if he can see it, I should be able to go out and see it.
So that's what Barbara did. She got in her boat, sailed out into the bay, and for the first time saw what Captain Vancouver was talking about. In the foothills, just south of Mount Rainier, is a divot. It looks like a piece of the snowy ridge has been chipped off. Barbara thought the abrupt division deserved to have a name.
And I thought that, well, it was appropriate that we name it Vancouver because it's V-shaped in honor of him.
So what does it take to name a place? Barbara didn't know, so she contacted Caleb Mackey, executive secretary for Washington's Committee on Geographic Names.
There's not too many ironclad rules. Really, the two big ones is no derogatory names, and if it's a commemorative name for an individual, they have to be deceased at least 5 years.
Well, there's a few more than just two. Like, the name can't be too long. It has to use the Roman alphabet. Also, possessives aren't allowed. So Vancouver Notch and not Vancouver's Notch. But despite all the rules, Caleb says that the most important thing is someone like Barbara,
the committee never actually goes out and names anything on its own. The public has to come to the committee first. So basically, we're at the mercy of the public.
Mr. Vancouver is already the namesake for a city in Washington and in British Columbia, a mountain in Alaska and one in New Zealand, a bay, an island, and a peninsula.
A lot of people would say, everything's been named Vancouver. Why bother? Well, if you don't bother, nothing ever gets done. Nothing ever gets accomplished.
In this spot, this one dot on the map, you can see multiple layers of Washington's history. The notch is created by two rivers named for local native tribes, Puyallup and Mowich. The land is controlled by Hancock Forest Management, a logging company with roots to Boston investors. No name stands alone. The names of places matter.
You know, I want to be able to go out and buy a map that says Vancouver Notch on it, to see it in hard copy.
And soon she will. Her proposal was approved in December. It will be on all new Washington State maps. For The World, I'm Whitney Henry Lester.
The story is part of a series from the World in Words team. They're digging into the stories behind unusual place names, roads, whatever you can think of. Wondering how something got its name? Tell them by emailing it to them at language@pri.org. Language@pri.org. You might just get your answer. Tomorrow on The World, thinking ahead to the fall.
My name is Valeria DeVille. I'm an undocumented student living in Boston, and I just received a full ride to Northeastern University for all 4 years.
Right on. DeVille is a high school senior who had the grades to get into college, but her immigration status was getting in the way, even though she has deferred action for childhood arrivals, known as DACA. College admissions forms don't include a box for undocumented immigrant, so DeVille set to work. She figured out how to apply and then showed her guidance counselors how to do it.
And they actually sent undocumented students to me so that I could actually help them in terms of like what scholarships were open to us, what schools were good to apply to.
A DACA student works the system. That's tomorrow on the program. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Some people will go to extreme lengths to achieve a goal. Here's the story of Maria Turk Pakai. She's a top squash player in Pakistan. She grew up in the Taliban-controlled region of Waziristan, and girls don't play sports there. So she had to pretend she was a boy. She even took on the name Genghis Khan. She tells her story in a new book, A Different Kind of Daughter. And I asked her about the day when she was almost five that she decided to burn all her dresses.
You know, in that young age, you know, a child just see the difference between happiness and unhappy. So I could see much more happiness on the boys' side, and I could see them freely moving around and playing different games and sports, and the clothing style was also very, you know, to me it was more comfortable and lighter. I think I felt that maybe it's the clothes that I have, so I one day I decided to burn them all, and I did it.
Well, interestingly, you got a lot of support from your father. He didn't scold you for burning your clothes. In fact, he was the one who gave you your male name, Genghis Khan.
He believes that, you know, when you beat a child or you, you know, you scold them, he will lose the courage and intelligence. So let them question you, let them, you know, do whatever they want. So he just smiled and he said, well, you know, you're my fifth son and your name is Genghis Khan from now on.
Wow. How hard was it for you and your family to keep the secret, your secret, that Genghis Khan was really Maria?
Well, you know what? I am really strong. It's very hard for people to realize that I'm a girl. At that age, you know, you're young. And, you know, you hardly see girls outside. And I didn't come across girls very much. And most of my life I spend with boys. And I'm very, very easily adopt the personalities or the environment. So I was very good at it. And I became one of them, like boys and same mentality. And for years, people didn't know who am I.
When you began playing squash, though, you started living openly as a girl again. Why
yes.
was that?
Well, I had to because when I became a member of a proper squash academy, they asked for my birth certificate, and that's how people came to know about me.
So that squash academy, interestingly, you got the recognition from President Musharraf, and then the Taliban finds out about you. They threaten you. They threaten the squash academy, too. And simply because you wanted to play sports and go against ancient patriarchal traditions in Pakistan, the Taliban targeted you?
Yes, because I wanted to play squash. And, you know, squash was something that meant a lot to me. And, you know, it was the reason that, you know, they threatened me and they threatened my family to death, and it was ongoing risk for us.
You left, ultimately. You now live in Toronto. What about your family? Where are they?
They're in Peshawar still. I'm in Toronto, and,
You know, telling your story, I got to say, it doesn't feel like, as you say, these things go on. It doesn't feel like the Taliban is going to listen and change their ways. What do you hope your story is going to do?
I think that through sports and through education, I can give hope. And I come from the same area. I come from the same people. Like, I'm from the same tribe. So, you know, I understand them. I understand the culture and speak the language so I can talk to them. I believe that by giving education and sports, I think I can turn the young generation into very positive citizens, and the Talibanization would go down with time just because they would have no one left to recruit.
Squash professional Maria Turpakai has just published her memoir, A Different Kind of Daughter, The Girl Who Hid from the Taliban in Plain Sight. Maria, great to meet you. Thank you so much, and good luck to you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Finally today.
I grew up in a rare house where nobody cooked.
Sabrina Gayor is a chef and author. She was born in Iran, but in 1979, the year of the Islamic Revolution there, Gayor's family fled. They ended up in Britain, where meals were kind of a mixed bag for Sabrina growing up.
My grandmother didn't know how to cook, my mother didn't know how to cook, and there was just nobody else in the family. So I grew up on a mixture of restaurant food, benevolent aunties, and just kind of things from the supermarkets. Convenience food was in a big way when I was a kid, thank God, because it meant we ate. I'm self-taught through and through, and I started cooking when I was 5. Watching sort of TV chefs on British television and falling in love with what they were doing.
This is some lovely fatty and gristly shin of beef.
And it's cooked in a rich red sauce. In fact, in India, they say that if a cook...
An Indian lady named Mada Jaffrey and a Chinese chef called Ken Hum.
Simple flour and water mixture. So it's very different from a European-type pancake, which is made from a batter. And for this, you need 10 ounces.
Being Iranian, but growing up British and going to school in England and shopping in English supermarkets with British or European produce is so different to the stuff that is in the Middle East. It gave me double the playground of flavors and produce and ingredients to play with. My mother is... I can't even say that she's a terrible cook because she just doesn't cook at all. But she really made my love for food grow. She introduced me to, you know, eating with chopsticks and took me for croissants when they weren't a thing and nobody knew what they were. She used to mix sort of Betty Crocker cake mixes for me as a kid, and that kind of was really the extent of cooking with my mum, but I have my kitchen memories. I remember my mum came home one night from a party and she came running into the kitchen. I just had this amazing dish and I'm going to make it tomorrow night. And those are like horrific words for my ears because it's like, oh God, here we go. She'd had this like tortilla-like omelette that had grated vegetables in it and grated cheese in it, and she loved it. And she was making it the next night, begging me to stay out of the kitchen, mostly probably just not to ridicule her. And she's grating this cheese, and things go silent. And a few minutes later, she just calls me and she's like, can you come in here, please? Came into the kitchen and I was like, what's the problem? She was like, this cheese. And I was like, what's wrong with the cheese? She was like, it's one of those cheeses that clearly doesn't grate. And I'm like, what do you mean one of those cheeses doesn't? It doesn't grate. It's not grating. It's probably a cheese that just doesn't grate. And I went, well, if you turn the grater around to the side where you can actually grate the cheese, it will grate. So, yeah, my mother is a very, very different being to me, and she just doesn't really have a clue about food, bless her, but she is the consummate appreciator.
That's Sabrina Gayor. Her latest cookbook is called Sirocco, Fabulous Flavors from the Middle East. She told her story to producer Alex Galifant. We've got a visual aperitif for you, lush photos of Persian food, over at PRI.org. And that'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with more of the world tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.